Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. New Yorkers, sometimes we like to think of our city as the only one in the world. Well, if not the only one, then the best one. Sometimes the worst one. Either way, New York likes to see itself as an exception, but a new book shows how much the world's cities really we all have in common, not just with each other, but also with our ancient predecessors. Monica L. Smith is an archaeologist and professor of anthropology at UCLA, and now the author of Cities, the First 6,000 Years. The book shows how much we can learn about today's societies from considering where they all came from. Right now, more than half the world's population lives in cities, and in just over a decade, as Smith writes, quote, more than 50% of Africans, 60% of Chinese, 87% of Americans, and 92% of the residents of the UK will live in cities. Monica, welcome to All of It.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the question you pose to us, the reader, is, you write, the question I would pose to you as a reader is, why cities? Are they the natural step in human habitation's evolution, or a response to something else?
So the way we can think about cities is not just the way that they encompass practically half of the world's population now, but where they came from in the first place, because cities are not the natural habitat of our species. Our natural habitat is living in small villages of 50 to 100 people, and that's the way our ancestors had lived for 100,000 years or more. And yet there was something about those villages that just wasn't quite enough to galvanize people into larger groups, and it wasn't enough to satisfy people when they wanted something different.
It's interesting you should say we are wired to be in small villages because, you know, in any big city like this one, we break ourselves down into areas. Greenwich Village, Chelsea, Upper West Side, Upper East Side. We break ourselves down into villages. Is that, historically, has that been the case within these big cities?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you can think of even your own apartment building as being a little bit like the size of a village. And even in archaeological terms, people break down their cities into smaller, more manageable units. I have a colleague, Elizabeth Stone, who works on Mesopotamian cities, and she's noted that the neighborhoods in Mesopotamian cities are about the same size as a Mesopotamian village. And so this kind of cellular idea of living in a smaller zone within a larger urban settlement is something that has been with us right from the very beginning.
We should probably define our terms. When you say city, what do you mean in the modern context and what do you mean in the ancient context?
So the scale of cities is quite different in the modern and the ancient period, of course. If we think about places like Mexico City is 21 million or Tokyo is about 39 million people, that's clearly much larger than any ancient city would have been. But the definition of a city as a place is the same for both those urban beginnings of 5 to 10,000 people as they are for the megacities of today. And that is a concentrated population in a small area, people who have specialized occupations, not just farmers and herders, but a whole variety of middle management jobs and production jobs, and even jobs doing things like transportation and carrying things around. And you have different kinds of buildings. We have spatial structures in modern cities that are very much like ancient cities. You have a downtown where you have concentrated architecture, maybe some special purpose administrative buildings. You have roads or canals or bridges that tie it all together. And then you've got big empty spaces that can be repurposed over and over again for a fair or a festival or maybe even for a demonstration, a parade, or even a riot.
I'm interested in, there's a couple follow-ups. One, can you make, what is the distinction between a megacity and a city in terms of modern context?
Sure. So many of the cities that we have today are growing into these larger urban conglomerations. So if we think about the New York-Boston corridor, for example, or if we think about cities in around Beijing, or if we think about cities in northern India that are all sort of growing into one another, that, again, is a question of scale that is bigger than ancient times, but is still quite similar. If we think about ancient Mesopotamian cities, for example, they were all within an easy day's sail of each other up and down the Tigris and the Euphrates, or Roman cities that were packed all around the Mediterranean, and you had the same kinds of things in every single city, whether it was in downtown Rome itself, or in North Africa, or in Turkey, or anywhere else.
have these large, I mean, the populations of some of these megacities that we have now, have they altered the idea of a city?
Not for the people who live in them. Cities are still the places where people want to come because there is an opportunity for employment. There's an opportunity for education. There's even an opportunity for entertainment that doesn't exist in smaller places. Think about where the big museums are. Think about where the big sports stadiums are and the sports franchises. They're all in cities.
It was also interesting to hear you describe so the characteristic of a city. There's a municipal area. There's an area for large gatherings. There's an area for housing. The question I guess I'm trying to get to is, did people create that or have people adapted to that?
Both of those things are true. When cities first started, their precursors were only blueprinted by the fact that people had occasionally come into ritual settlements beforehand. In all of those little villages, there was only one way that people could get together into larger groups, and that was ritual spaces, spaces like Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, or a place that might be more familiar to us, like Stonehenge. And the idea was that you came together with a number of strangers. You had to learn to get along. There was a fair or a festival or a ritual occasion. But the difference was that after the festival was over, you were supposed to go home. There was no way to make that a kind of permanent festival atmosphere until people started living in cities. And so at first, a city might be just a collection of houses, you know, traders that had stayed on a little bit longer, people who were hanging around, they put up a shack, and then somebody else put up a shack, and then after a couple of years, it was recognized that nobody was going anywhere. So more people came, more work started to be available, some of those shacks got torn down and then remade into somewhat better housing. And we can actually see this in the archaeological record, this process of beginnings that then become transformed into a permanent festival atmosphere.
My guest is Professor Monica Smith. The name of her book is Cities, the First 6,000 Years. So take me back 6,000 years. What's the first city?
So there are many claimants for the first city. You know, archaeologists are just like any other scientists. They want the biggest, the first, the earliest. But there are at least a couple of candidates in Mesopotamia. One of them is Uruk in southern Mesopotamia, what's now southern Iraq. And then a site called Tel Brak, which is now in Syria. And they're the two poles of a long chain of urbanism that started up and down the Tigris and the Euphrates. They were places that were a little bit difficult to live in, which actually means that the beginning of urbanism is slightly puzzling. The places that people lived in the first cities were challenging. They were hot, they were often suffering drought. They were places where people had to bring in a lot of resources. They were not easy places to live. And actually, maybe that's why they became successful, because people had to be more entrepreneurial in order to make it work at all.
So the first cities, you've mentioned the Tigris River, did they have to be near some sort of natural source of food, energy, anything like that?
Yes, absolutely, because cities always draw on their surrounding resources. People are not keeping goats in the city. People are not keeping a year's supply of grain in the city. And so the way that they get provisions and the way that we get provisions now is through a network of transportation that often would go along water bodies like lakes or rivers or oceans. And so we also make use of those same shipping technologies. It's still easier and cheaper to ship things by water than it is overland.
What happened in cities that failed? What historically causes a city to fail?
So we know that there are some cities that are now purely archaeological, including places like Tel Brak. They were places that were very successful for hundreds of years, and then afterwards the populations either dissipated slowly or there was some kind of catastrophic event. But catastrophic events are actually relatively rare. Most often it's because there are slight changes over time that mean that within a few generations, a city just isn't as popular as the other cities in the networks. There's rarely a case where an entire network of urbanism goes down. It's usually one or two. People then move to some other urban locale, much as they do today. And then they pick up the threads as migrants and insert themselves into a new urban center.
What's been the role of leadership historically in city success or failure?
leadership is critical because there are many things that happen in cities that can only be done at a centralized level. And one of the most important is infrastructure. Nobody builds their own street. Nobody digs their own canal to their house. Nobody lays their own sewer line. Those are things that all have to be done at a centralized locale and with an eye towards linking people together through this shared infrastructure. So when we think about the role of governments, both in the past and the present, we have some wonderful examples from ancient historical documents that talk about how leaders are making canals, how they build roads and bridges, the exact same kinds of things that we see today with historical or commemorative markers, foundation stones or brass plaques. Those are things that we also see in the archaeological record. Leaders like to claim their development of infrastructure.
My guest is Professor Monica Smith. The name of her book is Cities, the First 6,000 Years. You named four building blocks that were essential precursors for the development of cities. What are they?
So one of them is language, and that's something that our species has had for at least the last 100,000 years or so. And language is an important part of what eventually made urbanism possible, because language does not just describe what actually happens. It also describes what could happen. We can imagine things through language. We can say, if we build this structure, then we will have more people living here. If we build this metro extension, we'll be able to provide jobs to more people. If we construct something new, then we can make something new happen. So that's one of the important building blocks. Another building block is that our species has always been migratory, and most cities still grow by populations coming in. You know that kids are expensive, especially in cities. So city birth rates tend to be relatively low compared to the countryside. And all of our cities are growing all over the world because people migrate in. Another thing is the way in which humans love objects, and objects turn into trash. We can see that happening in every ancient city, so that trash is not a modern phenomenon. It's an urban one. And finally, we have architecture. The times that people first started to build something, like a Stonehenge, for example, turned into times where people were constantly changing their built environments by building themselves residences and special purpose architecture in cities.
It was so interesting to hear you describe building things. And of course, my brain went straight to, if we build it, they will come. So that's a line from a movie, a very famous sort of hackneyed line, but it sounds like it's true.
That's exactly true. I mean, think about Hudson Yards, for example.
What misconceptions do we get about ancient cities that we might get from either popular culture or a stroll through a museum?
So a stroll through a museum highlights for us beautiful objects and artifacts. You know, when you walk through a museum, you see all these lovely things in cases, and somehow you feel as though ancient aesthetics might be much better than our own in contemporary life. But there are so many things in museum basements that you never see, including many ugly artifacts and many things that were designed to be disposable.
For example,
there's something from ancient Mesopotamia called a bevel rim bowl, which is almost the equivalent of a modern styrofoam cup, for example. It's something that was made to be used once or twice and then thrown away, very much like the garbage that we see on New York City streets today, and was part of a food economy of takeout food.
Are there any issues that we have now in our cities that ancient civilizations handled far better?
Well, there's one problem that always besets any kind of city, and that is the problem of maintenance. So maintenance is the other side of infrastructure. Everybody loves to build a new building or develop something new, but having money for maintenance is something that has always plagued ancient cultures. So we have, for example, Japanese texts from the ancient site of Nara, where the officials are constantly telling people to sweep out the streets so that they don't become muddy. We know from archaeological evidence that the city of Rome was always having to maintain its aqueducts and its other infrastructure. So if there's something that we can learn from the past, is that maintenance is often just as costly as building new buildings or building new infrastructure.
I think you can't have a conversation in New York City with a New Yorker when gentrification doesn't come up. It comes up at least three times a week just on this program.
was gentrification an issue in ancient times, whatever that version of gentrification was?
Sure. If we think about gentrification as a reconstruction of existing housing stock, for example, by people who have a greater amount of wherewithal to do something with that same space, yes, absolutely, we can see gentrification and reconstruction in ancient cities. When archaeologists dig, we go down through these layers of building foundations. And I have a colleague, Andrew Dufton, who has done a very nice study of gentrification in the Roman world, in which you can actually see areas that were originally houses, you know, very small houses packed together into a neighborhood. In the next generation, somebody has come and taken out half of those houses to build a mansion. So that same impulse of reconstruction and, you know, these divisions into elite and non-elite groups, and then groups in the middle, is something we absolutely see in the past.
When you talk about gentrification now, a lot of people think about the idea of taking from one group, that you're taking the land, you're making it impossible for one group of people to be able to exist in their, what was, quote, their neighborhood. Is that a modern issue? Is that a modern because of inequity we have right now? Or has that happened before?
It's actually happened before, too, in the site of Teotihuacan, which is an amazing ancient capital, which is now just north of Mexico City. Archaeologists have discovered that under some of the building foundations, there are agricultural canals, and those buildings were occupied by people that we know to be migrants from the kinds of materials that are found there. And so this sense of perfectly good farmland being taken over by migrants or the development of new ethnic enclaves definitely came with some aspects of controversy. Sometimes we see at sites like Tel Brak, this very early city in Mesopotamia, there are places of violence. My colleague Augusta McMahon has excavated a kind of cemetery where you can see that people were killed. And those people are folks who had a lifetime of abuse, as you can see from like broken bones that have healed and so on. So cities have never been an absolutely delightful place to live. Many of the same human tendencies that we've brought along with us from the past, like violence and other kinds of controversies, do also show up in ancient cities.
My guest is Monica Smith. The name of her book is Cities, the First 6,000 Years. When you think about, I won't say the next 6,000. Let's think about the next 100 years, something that's actually within our grasp. What do you think, based on history, based on the way humans have lived and the way we have congregated and the way we have created cultures and environments, can you predict changes or things you think might happen to our cities in the next 100 years?
I think that all of the things that we see today are going to continue to accelerate. One of them is this increase of population growth. Even when cities are very challenging to live in, even when you see slums in many parts of the world, that does not discourage people from coming in. There does not seem to be a maximum number for the population that can live in an urban area. But all of that population growth also brings with it some efficiencies that mean that we can address social problems in a more effective kind of way. You have more people in cities, which means more potential for specialized medical care because you can reach those populations. You also have the potential for social justice in the development of infrastructure because every line of sewer, every line of subway reaches many more people than it would in a dispersed rural area. You can get the word out about social developments and education that you would like to see. So I think we can be very optimistic about cities as places that will continue to have a sense of forward motion, a sense of optimism, and a sense of diversity that you don't get in other places.
Is there an ancient city you think could be a model for the future city?
I think all ancient cities could be helpful, both in the positives and negatives that they convey. But what we see, for example, in a place like ancient Rome, is that there was a kind of cellular development in which there were high-end houses and middle-income houses and low-income houses all in the same neighborhoods, so that you didn't have areas in which only rich people or poor people lived. And that kind of cellular development is, I think, essential because when we think of what it takes to make a city, which ancient documents also tell us about. You need all kinds of people. You need not just CEOs, but you need people to deliver the mail. You need people who to work in food service that we all depend on here in cities. We need people to drive buses and sweep streets. And having all of those people live in close proximity to their work makes their lives better and means that we're more integrated with a whole variety of different people.
Is there a modern city in 2019 that you admire how it functions based on your scholarship?
So I think I'm sort of like the Will Rogers of cities. You know, he never met a person he didn't like. I never met a city I didn't like. And they all work to a greater or lesser extent in many of the same kinds of ways. But I think that cities that are voting for zoning regulations that keep in mind the potential for dense housing to be more accessible to greater numbers of people, cities that are aware of their ecological footprints, cities that are taking steps towards water conservation and hinterland management, cities are thinking about clean and green transportation, which is not just a matter of environmental efficiency, but also a matter of social justice. I think that capacity is within every city.
So Toronto. My guest has been Monica Smith. The name of the book is Cities, the First 6,000 Years. Thank you so much for joining us, Monica.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
This is All of It on WNYC.